Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this week's show, Harriet Wims will read from her story about the obstacles awaiting a lesbian seeking infertility treatments. CNN tells the truth about doctors who refuse to care for female patients, and I reply to the non-answers that some Republican candidates gave on abortion in the recent debate. Thanks to Flea at the blog Lock the Bedroom Door for reporting on some of the more confusing news from the world of sex tech. A German inventor has invented a spray-on condom for men who are too small or too large for the standard sizes. A worthy idea, but color me skeptical about how it works. You stick your penis into a pump that sprays it with latex, wait 20 seconds, and then you're ready to go. If your erection hasn't wilted from being sprayed with latex, and if it doesn't break, condoms aren't supposed to be completely skin tight. A little give at the end helps keep them from breaking, you know. Maybe a better idea is a greater variety in sizes of condoms? Apparently, the fact that some voters had the nerve, I tell you, to ask Republican candidates where they stand on abortion during the Republican YouTube debate is sending right-wingers into a tizzy. I'm not sure why, though. It's not like most candidates didn't do a magnificent job of dodging the question. The first question is a favorite one of mine to ask anti-choicers, since I have yet to hear one who will answer it directly. Shout out to a fellow Texan for having the ovaries to ask it.
In the event that abortion becomes illegal and a woman obtains an abortion anyway, what should she be charged with and what should her punishment be? What about the doctor who performs the abortion?
Congressman Ron Paul, how will you get out of saying that one-third of American women are murderers who should be in jail as we speak?
You know, it's not a federal function to determine the penalties for a crime of abortion if it's illegal in a state. It's up to the state. It's up to the juries. And it should be up to discretion because it's not an easy issue to deal with. But the first thing we have to do is get the federal government out of it. We don't need a federal abortion police. That's the last thing that we need.
Ah, the federalism dodge. Leave it to the states. Does Ron Paul really believe that the federal government needs to stay out of abortion? If so, then why on earth did he vote for the most sweeping federal anti-abortion legislation to come down the pipe, the federal partial birth abortion ban? Fred Thompson hides behind the ladies are too stupid to know what they're doing dodge that presumes that women aren't full citizens under the law but should be treated like minors who are unaware of their actions.
And it goes to the doctor performing the abortion, not the girl or the young girl or her parents, whoever it might be.
A favorite anti-choice dodge that makes no sense. If you honest to God thought that abortion was killing a human being, then procuring it or paying someone to do it is a crime that is equal or greater to performing the act for pay. If you hire a contract killer to kill your own child, that's a crime, is it not? If you think abortion is murder, shouldn't it be treated like murder? It's almost like anti-choicers are being insincere about this murder thing, and are in this because they oppose a woman's right to control her own body. Second question, same subject.
I would like all the candidates to give an answer on this. If hypothetically Roe v. Wade was overturned, and the Congress passed a federal ban on all abortion, and it came to your desk, would you sign it? Yes or no?
A bit more of a softball. Giuliani gives a straightforward answer.
I probably would not sign it. I would leave it to the states to make that decision.
Leaving it to the states is a popular answer. My suspicion is that your average sympathizer with the anti-choice view enjoys having the warm, fuzzy, misogynist feeling of having anti-sex legislation on their local books to make them feel they're in a morally upright community. But they also like the idea that abortion is legal in New York or wherever so they can get one when they need one. It's all cool as long as the appearance of rigid Puritanism is maintained. It's a great system, except for all the women who don't have the means to travel to another state to get an abortion. But I guess those women can be sacrificed for the sake of hypocritical morality that's all for show. It's worth noting that Giuliani is from a state where abortion would most likely stay legal if Roe v. Wade was overturned. Mitt Romney gives me pains with his devious answer. He's smart enough to jump on the leave it to the states bandwagon and then hedges his bets by saying he'd also sign a federal abortion ban. Either or, whatever you want.
I would welcome a circumstance where there was such a consensus in this country that we said we don't want to have abortion in this country at all, period. That'd be wonderful. I'd be delighted.
The question is, would you sign that bill?
Let me say it. I'd be delighted to sign that bill, but that's not where we are.
But I think what really churned my stomach was the idea that there's a single reason to think that not wanting to have abortion in this country has anything to do with abortion bans in the real world. Not wanting to have legal abortion, sure. Wanting women to die in back alleys or hotel rooms from desperately trying to self-abort, sure. Wanting women to be punished for the sin of sexuality with infertility, infection, and even death, sure. If that's what you want an abortion ban. But abortion bans have little to no relationship with this fantasy of stopping abortion. As long as women are getting pregnant when they don't want to be, there will be abortion. Harriet Wims is completing her PhD in child clinical psychology and community psychology at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Her dissertation explores the experiences and perceptions of doctoral students of color in psychology. She has an MS in developmental psychology from Johns Hopkins University and a BS in English from Towson State University. Her poetry has appeared in the anthology From the Listening Place. She lives in Baltimore, where she is the proud and busy mother of a 3-year-old boy. She's here today to read her story, Harrison, from the anthology of choice.
I'm going to start after I was divorced and had left my heterosexual marriage and had and my ex-partner, but my partner at the time and I, who is also a woman, had gotten together and decided that we wanted to start a family. So I'll start there. Now that I was divorced, I was considered a single woman by fertility specialists at my insurance company, whether or not I was involved in a same-sex relationship. I learned of these changes when I went to an appointment with my reproductive endocrinologist. Once so enthusiastic, her demeanor was now somber as I entered her office. "Well, now that you're divorced, things are a bit different," she said. "You need to call your insurance company first and find out if your treatments will be covered. Unfortunately, many of my single clients have a hard time getting these kinds of procedures covered. But I'm not single, plus I'm infertile." "Well, in the eyes of the law, you are single," she said. Her jaw was set, almost defensive. She sat up straight in her chair. "This is just how the regulations are written. Insurance companies usually only cover fertility treatments for heterosexual married couples. But you can always pay out of pocket and see if they'll reimburse you." I couldn't understand the words she was saying. They just did not compute. It couldn't possibly be true that insurance companies could discriminate on the basis of marital status, could it? Surely that had to be illegal. This, however, was just the beginning. I learned from talking to the medical office support staff, to Maryland Office of the Attorney General, and to the benefits coordinator at my job that this was, in fact, how my policy and most policies was written. The policies were blatantly discriminatory, but legally so. In 1997, in the state of Maryland, although most employers were required to include infertility treatments among the benefits covered by their employee health insurance packages, these benefits were requisite only if an employee was a member of a heterosexual married couple. Single women, lesbians, and even unmarried heterosexual couples were specifically excluded from these covered benefits. Therefore, despite my diagnosis of medically caused infertility, fertility treatments were not covered because of my sexual orientation. I was married, but my same-sex marriage was not recognized. Motherhood was no longer a medical necessity as it had been when I was in a heterosexual married relationship. Procedures which would have cost me $50 to $100 while I was married to a man would now cost me several thousand dollars per month. I was afraid I would be denied the opportunity to become a mother because I could not afford the medical procedures I needed, procedures that had been offered so easily when I was married to a man. I contacted my local ACLU office to find out if what was happening was legal. The representative I spoke to said I was not the first woman to relay this kind of story. He encouraged me to talk directly to the Human Resources Department and the benefits coordinator of my employer. These individuals blame the insurance coverage stipulations on the insurance company. The insurance company representatives replied that employers are responsible for developing their own benefits packages. Many medical insurance policies are still written this way, although I have been told that employers may opt to change their benefits packages so that treatments are covered for unmarried employees. The ACLU lawyer believed I had a case. However, if I chose to pursue it, I might draw significant media coverage. I declined their help, afraid that my job would be jeopardized by the negative press. I began writing letters to the Human Resources Department of my employer, to the Appeals Department of my insurance company, to the Maryland Insurance Commissioner, and the Office of the Attorney General, encouraging them to change their policies. But in the end, I was told nothing could be done. Regulations could not be changed for one person. What's worse, many physicians seem to believe that motherhood was no longer a right or even a reasonable consideration for me. My fertility specialist over the phone now suggested that I find a different practitioner because my insurance would not cover her services. Several hospitals and fertility treatment centers refused outright to provide me with services, not because of my ability to pay, but because I was a lesbian. One day, I walked into the office of a reproductive endocrinologist in the same building as my dentist. A picture of a mother and a child on the door had caught my attention. I thought, maybe this is a sign. The office was wallpapered in muted pink and blue swirls of faded silk flower arrangements on several end tables. The waiting room was empty. The receptionist pushed back a glass window. Yes, may I help you? Yes, I said, I have a quick question. Does the doctor offer services to single women or lesbians? She said hesitantly, you'll have to talk to the doctor about that. Well, is the doctor available? I'm having a hard time finding a doctor who will work with me, and I'd like to talk to him to ask. No, hon, she interrupted, the doctor isn't available. He only sees people by appointment. What about a nurse? Or the office manager, I replied, nearly in a whisper. No, ma'am, you'll have to ask the doctor about that. I left the office after grabbing the doctor's card. That afternoon, the same receptionist transferred my call immediately to the physician. I asked him about his willingness to offer artificial insemination to lesbian couples. I can't help you, he said. I'm sorry, I said. No, I cannot help you. I don't approve of that sort of thing. And he hung up the phone. The next week, I called the Department of Reproductive Medicine at one of the most prestigious hospitals and universities in Maryland. When told that I could not access fertility services there, I asked to speak to the head of the department. The doctor returned my call late that afternoon. How may I help you? I told him that I had been diagnosed with PCOS and had not become pregnant after nearly 2 years of unprotected sex with my former husband. Then I told him about my domestic partnership and how none of the many doctors I had contacted would offer artificial insemination services to us. Miss Wims, he said, we simply cannot offer those services to you because you're not married. This is, of course, not a value judgment. You must look at it from the hospital standpoint. If we inseminate you, and then let's say you die, the hospital would be liable. I don't understand, I said, perplexed. We could be sued for paternity. I laughed out loud before realizing he was serious. Well, I said, recovering, what if I sign some kind of contract that states that you won't be sued if I die? Our lawyers wouldn't allow us to do that. Good day.
How did your family cope with the ups and downs that led you to finally giving birth to Harrison?
Well, as I say later on in my essay, one of the things that I did was we started finding a community to help us. So we actually went to the internet and I joined a listserv for lesbian moms. And these were for moms who were trying to get pregnant, And also moms who already had children through bio means, and also who had adopted children or had become stepmothers. And they offered a lot of support. They really kind of helped normalize what was a terrible situation, because it just didn't compute that I could be discriminated against so blatantly because of my marital status and because of my sexual orientation. And these women were saying, yep, it's true. Okay, so it sucks. Now what are you going to do about it? And we also had a really strong community of friends who were equally appalled, but also just kept saying, you're meant to be mothers. You're meant to be mothers, and it's going to happen whatever way that's going to happen. And as I also said in my essay, one of my friends did say to me after I thought, you know, well, we'll just give up, and maybe we're not meant to have children, or, you know, maybe adoption will become a possibility for us. Who knows? And she said to me, you never, ever give up. This is not the Harriet that I know. And that really spurred me on to find some other options.
You didn't have a traditional journey towards single motherhood, but a single mother is how you describe yourself now.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about the status of single mothers in our society versus partnered lesbian mothers?
Oh, I think that single mothers, particularly in our society as it is right now, have a hard time because, and I think also it interweaves with our ideas about socioeconomic status, because I think for women who have the means, there is a message that says it's best to stay home with your children and to raise them while you're young. And at the same time, if you are a single mom, there's also the pressure to, of course, provide for your children. If we think back to how the welfare laws changed a few years ago, poor women are now required after a certain amount of time to go out and work, and that's how they care for their children. And so there's a discrepancy between single motherhood for women of means versus women who have to work. And I say all that to say it's hard to be a single mom and to work. There's a double standard there. If you think about it, most pediatricians' appointments are during the day, and you know, if you do get your child in a daycare, well, the daycare provider isn't going to take children to those kinds of appointments. And it's just, I feel like single moms are stuck between a rock and a hard place in many ways. There just aren't the accommodations in our society to help us, especially if we're working class, to help us be financially secure and to be able to be with our children as much as we'd like to be.
If you'd like to read Harriet's stories and others, please check out the book Choice, True Stories of Birth, Contraception, Infertility, Adoption, Single Parenthood, and Abortion. Thanks so much for coming on a Reality Cast, Harriet.
Sure.
CNN recently had a segment on the growing movement of medical workers with anti-choice views pushing those views on patients. I watched it, waiting for the usual tiptoeing around the anti-sex, anti-woman views of anti-choicers and the usual pretending that they're primarily motivated by saving babies. Luckily, the segment hit the truth about anti-choicers right off the bat.
He told me that he didn't believe in prescribing birth control. He thought it was morally wrong, that I shouldn't be having sex. And he launched into a lecture about, you know, ethically, you know, how I need to rethink things.
They interviewed Dr. Scott Ross, a Catholic doctor who delivers moralizing lectures instead of prescriptions when women come to him seeking contraception.
The struggle is always there.
Dr. Scott Ross, a Catholic family physician in Virginia, believes contraception interferes with God's plan to breathe life into us, so he doesn't prescribe birth control.
So if someone came to you today and said they would like contraception or the morning after pill. What do you tell them?
I'm very frank with them and say that's something that I don't do. It's not part of my practice.
Dr. Ross says he has denied contraception to at least a dozen patients.
Do you ever feel as though you're playing the role of judge too?
No.
But when you're denying someone something that they're requesting, aren't you making a judgment on whether or not they should have that care?
I don't know that I'm making a judgment on whether or not they should have the care. It's just the judgment of, I can't provide that care.
Splitting hairs. But I'm thinking that it's very rarely an apologetic, sorry, I can't do that kind of thing. I'm guessing once you're actually in the doctor's office and a bit of a captive audience, you get disapproving stares at the least, at worst a lecture about how you should be pumping out one baby after another if you're going to be naughty enough to have sex. Women who are getting shot down for their requests for basic care certainly feel judged.
Did you feel as if he was judging you?
Yes. Yeah, I really did. I felt as though he was accusing me of being immoral and trying to impose his values on me.
Of course he was judging her. Later in the show, they have a representative from the American Medical Association come on and give the AMA's general view on the issue, which is that medical workers have the basic right not to do things that they find immoral, no matter how silly their moral framework. But they also have an obligation to make sure the patient gets the care she needs, which is absolutely not happening. In fact, there's been reports of pharmacists snatching away birth control prescriptions and refusing to relinquish them, doctors refusing to give referrals, and of course there's the entire issue with emergency rooms. If you've been raped and you're looking for emergency contraception, you don't have time to get a referral and call someone in the morning. The sooner you swallow the pills, the more likely you'll escape pregnancy. Needless to say, the stonewalling of women who need emergency contraception means that anti-choicers are effectively guaranteeing there will be more abortions than there would be otherwise. Said before, worth repeating. Given the choice between preventing abortion and punishing a woman for being sexual or even being raped, they'll choose the latter, every time. The thing that bothers me especially about doctors who see the patients and then tell them no on contraception is that they're being kind of sleazy if you think about it. Your average gynecologist knows that a good percentage of his business, probably half I'd bet, is going to be in helping women control their fertility. If you're unwilling to do half your friggin' job, you should be willing to put a big sign over the door that says, "Will not prescribe birth control, so don't even ask." Why not do it? Well, with a sign like that, you wouldn't have half-naked women cowering in front of your lecturing judgments, nor would you have the pleasure of making them pay for the favor. Thus, the bait-and-switch technique. Now for the wisdom of wingnuts, this time a find from Pam Spalding. The latest wingnut cause of alarm? People are using their hotel stays more for having sex than engaging in spontaneous conversions to Christianity. It takes a special kind of person to find that news shocking.
The American Hotel and Lodging Association says use of religious materials in rooms at luxury hotels has dropped by 18% since 2001. Conversely, many of the new wave upscale boutique hotels, designed to cater to a younger leisure travel market guest as opposed to the shrinking business guest clientele, are adding amenities like condoms, intimacy kits, and sexually oriented games. Meyer thinks the intimacy kits and sex games are still elements incorporated into the extreme end of his industry and are not mainline hospitality fare yet, though he admits that the removal of Bibles represents the growing sentiment to be politically correct in an atmosphere of cultural warfare.
So many things wrong with that clip, starting with the implication that a cadre of PC types, probably radical feminists, hippies, and college professors, is swapping out Bibles with baskets of condoms. In reality, it's the invisible hand of the free market at work. And here I thought the free market was a god only second to the Christian god, and sometimes not even that. But what really gets me is how the fundies proclaim themselves the defenders of family values, and yet they can't even value marriage enough to tolerate the things married people do to bond. Don't they want marriages to stay together? I bet if anyone cared to research it, they'd find that massage oil holds more marriages together than the dusty Gideon Bibles in hotel rooms ever could.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.